afternoon or good evening, depending on where you are in the world, and welcome to Information Week Live for the week of March 20th, 2016. I'm Kurt Franklin, Executive Editor of Information Week, and your host for this episode of Information Week Live. Once again, we have a great episode lined up for you, although this one, well, it's got a little bit of a wistful tinge to it because we have to say goodbye to one of our regular members here. Well, to get us started and to let you in on the secret here in just a minute or two, let me introduce the editors who have joined me around the virtual table here. We have Sarah Peters, Senior Editor at Dark Reading, who's with us. Welcome, Sarah.
Thank you for having me, Kurt. It's a pleasure as always.
And Dave Wagner, my fellow Executive Editor at Information Week. Dave, welcome to Information Week Live.
Thanks, Kurt. Happy to be here.
Well, let's get started and take a look at just some of the big stories for the week, you know, the things that were exciting. Dave, let me turn to you first. What caught your attention this week out there in the big wide world of IT?
There were a lot of things, but the one that had the biggest combination to me of both humor, but actual importance to the enterprise is that Microsoft had created a new chatbot named Tay, and Tay was introduced to the world, and about 24 hours later, Tay started spouting horrible racist things to the world through Twitter. The reason for that is that Tay reflected our own horribleness. Tay was designed as a machine learning tool that would soak in what it learned from the internet, how people communicated to it, and unfortunately, reflecting the entire internet, it reflected not only nice things, but horrible things. And when you're Microsoft, you don't want to create a bot that says horrible things. So, So they, of course, shut it down very quickly. What's fascinating about this, of course, is that it reflects our own fears about what will happen when we set computers and artificial intelligence out into the wild. And, it looks bad. When we see computers learning from people and they're learning the bad things, we worry that any future computer we send out does the same thing. So it's a big story. It's also, I have to admit, a pretty funny story.
Well, to me, it's like they never actually looked at the internet before they unleashed their AI.
Well, I actually have a question about it, Dave, because I had seen the story and then I was a little bit unclear. Were they drawing from things that were that was direct interaction with that chatbot on Twitter? So that people were actively trying to teach it horrible things, or was it a natural? Was it just gleaning lessons from all over the place?
Right. Well, Tay's very first tweet was, "The more you interact with me, the more I learn." Mm-hmm. So I have no doubt that some people were trying to mess with it.
Yeah.
But at the same time, there's no evidence that there was, say, a concerted – or I shouldn't say there's no evidence. There's no evidence that I'm aware of that there was a concerted effort to taint it just for entertainment's sake. That may have come out, and I haven't heard that yet. But I think the reality is that its job was to consume all of Twitter. Twitter has some really awful corners, just like humanity. So my guess is that it's not going to take long for Microsoft to go back and to develop a kind of filter to learn how to do this, but not be quite so easily manipulated. At the same time, though, this is a real issue because For those who may not have known, a couple weeks ago, I did an article for Information Week that interviewed several Georgia Tech robotics professors who were trying to teach robots to learn skills by listening to humans tell them how to do it. And their reason they were excited about that is because they felt like it would democratize the robot, that it would allow a robot to be programmed by anybody rather than by a highly skilled robot or a highly skilled programmer. And that sounded fantastic to me, and I thought that sounded like a lot of potential. All of a sudden, it sounds a little less fantastic. and I'm sure, of course, everybody who's involved in this is going to be able to rethink this and work through this. This isn't the end of robots learning from humans, but it is the first of what is going to be, I'm sure, many interesting roadblocks to it.
It's amazing that Microsoft didn't see this coming. But what makes me think of is a company that I spoke to at RSA last month called Deep Instinct. I think that the term that they were using, I'm not positive, I think it was deep learning, which was beyond machine learning. And the way that they described it to me was that they teach this security application. I think it was an appliance, but they teach it simply by feeding it huge amounts of information and simply saying, this is malicious, this isn't, without telling it any parameters as to why this is malicious and this isn't. And they let the application figure it out on their own. And the idea behind it being that's how humans learn. Like, we just say, okay, somebody says to you, that's a dog, that's a dog, that's a dog, that's a dog. And none of these dogs look the same. But eventually, it takes you a while to learn it, but eventually, from then on, you recognize a dog when you see it. And you can watch the Westminster Dog Show, and you know that all of those things, no matter how weird, how different a Pekingese is from a German Shepherd, you know that they're both dogs because you learned it. And that is a new method that is very, very different, but really kind of goes beyond where machine learning was and is much more similar to the way the human brain acts. So I'm wondering, had they used something like that with Tay, if it would have gone any differently? Maybe
right.
Tay
well,
would have fought back and said, I don't understand, and who do I vote for?
Right. Well, I want to comment first on the very first thing you said at the beginning of your comment, which is that you're surprised Microsoft didn't see this coming. I'm not 100% sure Microsoft didn't see it coming.
You think they might have done it as an experiment?
Well, I'm sure they didn't know exactly what was coming. But to me, this is the kind of failure that you want to have happen, right? I mean, for multiple reasons. First of all, we're talking about it, right? It's a much more interesting failure than many others. The second is that this is how you learn to figure out what the minefield is, right? The verbal minefield is. So, to me, this is kind of the equivalent of what you're talking about with this is a dog, this is a dog, this is a dog. This now we can say this is hate speech, this is hate speech, this is hate speech, right? And before, it may not have been possible for what Microsoft had advanced so far to be able to do that, right? So I look at it as the exact kind of failure we want to have on the way to doing something better. But it is obviously still frightening. you can't get around the fact that one day we're going to unleash something that we can't unteach, right? that's the scary thing, right?
Have they said what their plans are for her?
Excuse me. I am unaware. If they have one, I apologize. I don't know. But my belief is that they'll go back to the drawing board and come out with something better, probably something a little safer. But, you know, we interact with more artificial intelligence in chat than we're necessarily aware of. I ran into one, I won't say what product it was, but I ran into one a couple of days ago while looking for a new phone provider. It took me quite a while to realize I wasn't talking to a person, but it eventually became clear when I kept having to ask the same question multiple times because it kept giving me a cut and paste of a part of marketing material over and over again. and it was the same one no matter how I phrased the question. So, this is a big business. So Microsoft's not going to abandon this because of this. And of course it's a holy grail of programming too because of Alan Turing and his Turing test. So we're nowhere near the end on this. And I'll give the person who programmed the AI credit. It took me a full probably 3 to 5 minutes to recognize I was talking to an AI and not a person. That was pretty good.
That sounds pretty darn cool. Well, that is a great story, and I think it's probably a story that in years to come we will look back on and say that this was possibly an important point in the evolution of AIs and in what happens on the web. But Sarah, I wanted to turn to you and find out if there was a big story that you saw this week that made you sit up and go, my goodness, what an important story that is.
Well, I think one of the things that I found it encouraging this week was that the U.S. charged three hackers from the Syrian Electronic Army, which is very well-known kind of hacktivist group, and then also indicted seven Iranian hackers, and that are associated with the Iranian government, and why that is sort of significant. Although these people are indicted, that doesn't mean that they're arrested. That doesn't mean that they're ever going to necessarily be in prison or anything. And I say that because a few years ago, the U.S. indicted a number of members of a Chinese organization that is associated with the Chinese government, and they haven't ever been they haven't ever seen a courtroom in the U.S. But what's interesting about it is that when those Chinese hackers were first indicted, it was the first signal that the U.S. had changed its policy about stuff. For a long time, there was no attribution for cybercrimes was something that everybody was very hesitant to do, partly because there really wasn't enough information. There wasn't enough data. We didn't know enough to really come out, point fingers with confidence. So saying it's the Russians, it's the Chinese, it's the government, saying anything like that was pretty irresponsible. Now attribution has gotten we've gotten more effective at it, but of course that introduces new complications, particularly political complications, because once you know that, what do you do with that information? Do your political leaders say to the political leaders of the government from where that attack derived, do they say, hey, cut it out, we know this was you, and we've got evidence to prove it. And if they don't cut it out, what repercussions are there going to be? Is there going to be blame? Are there going to be some kind of sanctions on them? So when that happened with the Chinese recently, that was a big deal. And now with the seven Iranis this week, that was another big step in that direction. And, you know, there's people who are, and I'm one of them, who have somewhat mixed feelings about it, but it's definitely significant thing. So I think it is a story worth noting this week.
So, Sarah, can I ask you, we know that a lot of cyber attacks are rooted, you know, through multiple different computer systems, and all sorts of things happen to try to make it hard to trace where attacks came from.
Mm-hmm.
It seems possible then to me that one of two things could be true, that you might not be all the way to the bottom of the barrel as to who did it, or also that it would get easier and easier to cyber frame a country or a person. Do you feel like we're at the place where we do feel more certain that when we say, hey, the Chinese did this, the Russians did this, whoever did this, that we can be sure we're accurate? Or are we at the point where we just feel politically safe saying Iran did it because everybody has been trained to not like Iran? You
That's
know?
A really I mean, great question. No, it's an excellent question. I asked a similar question, actually, of Richard Baitlick, who's a kind of a security rock star, kind of a leader in this topic. And what he talks about is the difference between high confidence attribution and low confidence attribution, and that the ability within different regions to provide accurate attribution, it does really vary. Within Russia and within U.S., we have pretty high abilities to do attribution. There's a lot of cybersecurity expertise here, and there's a lot of cybersecurity expertise over there. Particularly, like Kaspersky Lab in Russia has superb experts in forensics over there. So if they say this was whoever, if they're lying, that might be a totally different thing. But if they're not lying, I think that their ability to know the difference to be able to see through all of those proxies and to know when they found the actual source and know that it wasn't just the last proxy before the actual source. They're pretty good. They're very good now at knowing the difference between those two. That capability is not necessarily the same if you go to other countries, and that's where things get complicated, because a nation-state hacker who wants to, or hacked, whatever, whoever the threat actor is, if they want to stir up trouble between two countries, like somebody says, I want to stir up some more trouble between China and Japan, whatever, they could go in and try to cyber frame somebody, as you said, and one of those countries might not have the same capabilities, and they could see it wrong and be fooled. It's a great question.
So I assume this is done through a combination of, you know, tracking where the attacks started, but also by looking at the kind of tools that were used, a sort of like a cyber style, basically a fingerprint,
mm-hmm.
like no different than if I'm watching like a graffiti artist on a wall, everybody has a certain style, right? So I'm assuming that this is done that way as well. Does that make, you know, cyber framing more likely, but also does it mean that there's going to be a premium out there for governments to hire people from other regions that have, say, different styles, different fingerprints than the ones that we associate with certain countries or certain regions?
That's another really great question, Dave. You should do this. You should do this as a career. That's already an issue because, yes, there are certain groups that have tactics that are very, that they tend to do, and then of course they'll change their tactics. But they've got kind of their personal style, and then there are binaries within the code that are kind of a fingerprint of them. But most attackers, including nation state attackers, develop their own malware. They don't all develop their own attack tools. They'll buy them or they'll buy components of them. So there will be binaries that were, there'll be pieces of code that were written in France that are being used in China. There'll be pieces that were, written in China that are being used in Germany and, being used in the U.S. And there'll be, the CIA will go on the black market and buy a piece of, malware that they use against Iran, and they might have bought it from somebody in Iran. Like, it becomes more complicated to track down, track these people down, because a lot of it also, some of those transactions will happen on the deep web where there's anonymized communications happening, and it's happening with Bitcoin, which is an anonymized monetary system. So it's the whole market is built to muck up the works, and yeah, it gets complex. Everybody's getting better at attribution, but it's also, as that's happening, they're going to have to keep getting better and better at it, because the evolution of cybercrime business is becoming more complex, if that makes sense.
Well, now, one of the things that I think is really interesting, we've had two really great stories and discussions, but to me it says a lot about the state of the industry at this moment that there are two things that we're not talking about so far. One of those is that the FBI, after a month or so of dedicated brinksmanship, got right up to the day before the court date. They said, and I think that is fascinating. That somehow at the last minute, they realized that they might just have a way into the iPhone, that didn't require Apple to write a new iPhone operating system. And, I'm curious, is that something that we think is just, a run-of-the-mill story? Do we think this is going to crop up again? And to keep things on the Apple train, Apple introduced a new iPhone, a new iPad, and a new mobile operating system at the beginning of the week, and we're not talking about that either. And I wonder whether that should be worrying for those people who have Apple in their stock portfolio.
Well, I can tell you, as far as the FBI thing goes, I did find that very intriguing, that the FBI was like, oh, yeah, maybe never mind about that. Because just before that had happened, there was a story that had come out about the fact that some researchers at Johns Hopkins had discovered a way a weakness in the encryption that Apple uses to secure iMessages, so that you they could do kind of a man-in-the-middle attack on your iMessages and pluck your encrypted photos and things like that out of them. Now that would not be, and then it could also access those things stored in iCloud before messages are sent, because before you send a message, the draft of it will be saved in the iCloud for up to 30 days. That's not something that would have helped the FBI do what they were doing, but it did show that there are weaknesses in encryption and that there are weaknesses in things that Apple is doing to secure their device. So it kind of, they were basically coming out and saying, you know what, this thing is not necessarily all that secure. Maybe if you do a little work, you can figure it out yourself and stop bugging us with all this other stuff. And then shortly thereafter, the FBI said, a third party came to us and, you know, maybe we don't need to talk to you anymore, Apple. We'll get back to you. It was interesting timing, and it did raise my eyebrows. Let's put it that way.
Dave, are you as suspicious as Sarah is about this?
Well, I think Sarah nailed it. I don't think I could add anything more to the security discussion. I think I would just like to say something I said a couple weeks ago on this show, which is, what did we think was scarier? Apple opening the phone for the FBI, or the FBI finding a third party to do it for them? And it scares me more that the FBI themselves learned how to do this, or that the FBI found somebody willing to do it for them. That, to me, that's worse than thinking that maybe cooperation through a warrant, through some sort of you know, agreed upon system, I think that would have been better than letting the FBI figure it out themselves. So that's what worries me the most about this story.
And I should mention that I think it was in the fall. I could be remembering it wrong, but I think it was this like September. Some organization, some business that buys vulnerabilities. It's one of the kind of organizations that I was talking about before that buys and sells zero-day vulnerabilities and malware. Put out a bounty for a remote code execution vulnerability for iOS. And they said, if you can give us one, we'll pay you $1 million. And they paid somebody $1 million. We don't know who, and we don't know what we didn't find out what the vulnerability was, because, you know, if we found out, then it wouldn't be worth $1 million anymore. But somebody out there figured out a way to break it. Somebody was willing to pay $1 million for it. And they would only be willing to pay $1 million for it if they knew that they could sell it on to somebody else for more than $1 million.
Right.
This stuff is worth a lot of money. So if the FBI, whether the FBI actually had a third party come to them and it was, you know, just a concerned citizen, or whether it was a third party who said, hey, I can do this for you for, you know, a cool mill or what, we don't know. Or whether it was the FBI bluffing. I mean, we just don't know. But I think you're right, Dave, that is a concern that maybe we haven't talked about enough with all of this, that not only is it possible for the government and our intelligence agencies to come up with this stuff on their own, but there are people on the dark side of things who would be willing to do this for a price.
Right, and $1 million, frankly, is a bargain. I'm not trying to be flip about it, because it's a frightening and scary thing, but it's so scary that it shows you how little $1 million really is worth in this case. You know, frankly, if you told me that somebody paid $1 billion for it, I wouldn't have been shocked. I, you know, I mean, like, it is worth $1 billion in terms of the amount of money that you could the amount of money you could get out of exploiting that.
Depending on how fast you can make that money before the rest of us find it.
It's not
chump change, but compared to the potential, it's not an unreasonable sum to ask for at all.
Well, you know, I can remember when $1 million was real money.
I'd still take it.
Yeah, I wouldn't turn it down.
For example, back in 2010, when the three of us started working together, back at a publication now shuffled off to the bit bucket called Enterprise Efficiency, Dave and Sarah and I joined the staff of that publication within a week of one another at about the same time. And now the forces of economics and, frankly, one of our teammates' unbridled greed and willingness to do anything to move forward in a career is breaking up this old gang. And today is Dave Wagner's last day to sit around the virtual table with us. Dave, it's been a good ride for us and those others who have joined our team and whose team we have joined. So is there anything that you, first of all, can you give us any information about what you're going to be doing when you're not doing this anymore?
Sure. Well, first of all, let me say this 5 years has been a pleasure, not only to work with you and Sarah and Susan and the iWeek team and everybody at UBM, but also I just want to say thank you to the people who've been listening to me jabber on for 5 years, people who've listened on the radio, on video, who've read my content, who've been with us for a very long time. I will miss each and every one of you. It has been a fantastic community to be a part of. That is the hardest part about leaving, is leaving you guys. So thank you very much for 5 years. And I hope to still be around as a member of the community and see all of you. I hope to come even back on the show if I'm welcome at some point. But to give you a quick rundown, I don't know how much I should say, but I'm leaving to become director of research at Computer Economics, so an IT research firm. So I'm looking forward to a new challenge. But most importantly, I'm looking forward to being a part of this community as just a regular citizen, just to keep being part of Information Week and iWeek Radio.
Well, we hope to have you again in your civilian garb, but before we rip off your epaulets and break your journalist sword over our knees, I'm curious, you know, are there any stories from the past 5 years that stand out for you for one reason or another?
Yes, there are tons, but there are just a couple I want to focus in on. The first is the amazing number of things that can be done with carbon nanotubes. People, I'm sure, are really tired of me talking about carbon nanotubes. In fact, I made a real effort to stop talking about them after a while because I didn't want people to think I had gone into some sort of carbon nanotube investment mode. But one of my favorite things about following carbon nanotubes for the last 5 years is watching a technology that I had literally never heard of 5 years ago when I first covered it become something that I think very soon we're going to see used in a lot of ways to change IT. We have seen in the last 5 years prototypes of carbon nanotube batteries that are going to make it so that you can buy a smartphone and never charge it again in the life of the phone, that it could conceivably go for years on a single charge. We've seen them used in 3D printing of organs. We've seen it used in all sorts of really fascinating ways. And one of the sad things for me is that I'm not going to get to write the article about the first time a carbon nanotube is used in a production device in IT. I really wanted to be there to say, I told you so, I told you this, you know, years ago. This has been my obsession. So I'm really hoping that when it happens, I can write something for Information Week to say, see, this was my baby and it came true. So that's probably the number one. And then the other one is, I probably did 4 or 5 stories about Facebook analytics and what they could do that I found fascinating. And my favorite one all time was in November of 2014, when Facebook announced that it will predict when you break up with your boyfriend or girlfriend before you know. to me, that was fantastic. And one to bring us up to the present, and then I'll let people go on with the future without me, is years ago, believe it or not, when Disney first bought the rights to Star Wars, we didn't really talk very much about Star Wars Episode 7, which is now out. But what we did talk about was the rumor, and at the time it was only a rumor, that there would be a young Han Solo movie. And when I wrote that article, it got more traffic and more comments than any other article I've ever written before or since. And it let me know at the time how much that Disney would enjoy owning Star Wars. But it also let me know how much fun it is to talk about this. And what's great is right now, as we speak, Disney has narrowed down the selection of the young Han Solo to 3 actors. 3 actors, I have to admit, I have never, ever heard of. And I just want to say that the answers our community came up with, including Daniel Radcliffe and Channing Tatum, would have been so much better than the ones that Disney has stuck with now. So I think it's fun that I wrote a speculative story years ago, and we're still waiting to find an answer. But that answer is coming soon, and I wish I could buy a ticket to the Han Solo movie to everybody on the various communities that I've talked about this with and go see it together. I think that would be a lot of fun.
Well, Dave, I will say that when you wrote that story, I would have said that the odds of a young Han Solo movie were much greater than the odds of another Indiana Jones film starring Harrison Ford. But as it turns out, they're both equally likely. just shows why I am not a reporter for the entertainment industry. Well, but before we send you off, Sarah, I'm curious. We've done a lot with and around Dave. Any last words for him before we unceremoniously shove him off the lifeboat?
Well, I have to say that some of my favorite Dave related moments. One of them was definitely among the first video blogs at Enterprise Efficiency was Dave. Dave did it in the bathtub. clothed, but there were definitely a lot of like rubber ducky things around, which I found delightful. And it's always been so fun to work with him because, I mean, Kurt can attest, Dave's just one of the most creative people that I've ever known. And it is really depressing that he's not going to be around for us to laugh with and laugh at. anymore. And both of them, I mean, both of them in relatively equal quantities. So, Dave, I'm really, really delighted for you. And goodbye forever. And never come back again.
I feel like it's going to be that moment in Star Trek when Worf gets dispossessed by the entire Klingon Empire.
you can't see it, but Sarah and I are even now turning our backs on you here around the virtual table. Well, yeah, let me add my voice, Dave. It has been a pleasure and a privilege to work with you. I too will miss your insight and your creativity, and appreciate the fact that you have been a truly valuable member of the various teams on which we have worked, and have made every one of the teams better than it would have been without your presence. So I know that you're going to be successful, that despite our deep misgivings, we will be talking again in the future as we seek out your expertise. And, you know, for those who else might be seeking out your expertise, tell us one last time how to keep up with you on Twitter. Are you getting a new Twitter handle now that things are changing?
I might, but for now, you can still find me at Geekend Dave. That's weekend, but with a G, as I say to my children and to all of you every week. Find me there, and if I do go somewhere else, I'll be sure to let you know there where it is that I'll be heading.
Thank you so much. And Sarah, where can people keep up with all of your electronic comings and goings via the social media networks?
You can find me at Sarah Peters on Twitter, no H in Sarah.
As for me, just follow me on Twitter at KG4GWA. And we appreciate you taking the time out of your week to listen to us here on Information Week Live. Now, if you're listening to us on a podcast or streaming version, we appreciate it, but want to let you know that we do broadcast live every Friday at 3 p.m. Eastern. We'd love to have you listening to us live because there is a live text chat that goes on alongside the show. We'd love to have your voice in that conversation. But now, for the last time, for Dave Wagner, for Sarah Peters, and me, Kurt Franklin, thanks so much for listening. We'll see you next time.